On this week's 51%, hear about families in China donating equipment to a college. A film looks at women outside the prison system.
One piece of the puzzle that was really missing was the way in which women support loved ones inside and the rippling effect of incarceration.
And Gilles Malkin profiles a doctor who took a stance in the face of corporate pressure. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. A number of families in China banded together and donated personal protective equipment to Poughkeepsie, New York-based Vassar College during the COVID-19 pandemic. The PPE has gone to students on the Poughkeepsie campus who could not go home, as well as employees. The majority of the PPE, though, has been donated to local hospitals and first responders. I spoke with a Vassar professor who worked with the families in China. Once New York pause took effect toward the end of March, requiring non-essential businesses to close and mandating social distancing, Vassar, like many colleges, switched to distance learning. Pepe Q, the Louise Boydell and Alfred Lichtenstein Chair Professor of Chinese and Japanese at Poughkeepsie-based Vassar College, says not all students left campus.
Vassar is one of the few colleges that allow the student who couldn't, go return home or home environment is not, possible for them to continue to do online learning, to stay on campus. So Vassar had about 180 students, domestic students, and also 48 for students from China. They are international students. I work as a class advisor for the class of 2021. And the weekend before the spring break, one of my class student parents, the student is Hu Xinyue, and her mom called me from China and talked about, because Xinyue was one of the students stayed on campus. So her mom talked about the situation in New York, and she was very concerned. During the conversation, I mentioned the severe shortage of the medical protective gears in New York State, both in the medical hospitals and first responders, as well as on campus. So she immediately took action and told a group of Chinese parents about the situation, and they launched a donation campaign to support our battle against the pandemic. I was really deeply, moved by their compassion. And since that day, I think that was March 22nd, they organized a group of parents, about 74 of them, and they divided the team into four working groups, each group in charge of one aspect of the donation project. As a group, they donated 200,000, over 200,000 for Chinese yuan. And some individual faculty, family also donated to Vassar 12,600 Chinese yuan. And they also, as individual parents, they send the individual packages that the value of them put together is about 42,900 Chinese yuan. So estimatedly, this is not an accurate number. Some of them are still sending stuff to Vassar. But currently, I think the total number, in U.S. dollar is 36,700, about that much. They donated money and used the funds to purchase the material, because even they gave us money, in current situation, it's hard to acquire these materials, right? So it's more valuable for them to send the personal protective materials to us.
She says Vassar put together care kits for the students on campus, containing donated masks, along with Vassar's own resources of Tylenol, hand sanitizer, and disposable thermometers.
And Vassar also used the donated item to protect the essential workers on campus. In addition, donations from the parents, some of them they meant to share with the local hospitals and frontline workers. VASA has been in contact with the Dutchess Department for Emergency Responses and distributing, for instance, the protective gowns and N95 masks to the local healthcare providers, as well as like a fire department, people who are risking their lives in the front lines.
She says the effort of the parents in China shows humanity and profound love, especially as China itself is still recovering from the pandemic.
Their generosity is just so impressive. I feel honored to be able to help them. And I think in their action, we really see the strength of a community in responding to this kind of a global crisis. This is a community across continents. The Vassar parents, they call themselves part of a Vassar community, but they're in the other side of the globe. And this action, so far, 74 parents participated. Some of the parents, their children are no longer at Vassar. Their children graduated already. But when they heard about this, they say, I want to help too. They just jump in. This kind of action is, they're really heroes, I would say.
She says the families in China sent 3,000 N95 masks and 14,000 surgical masks, 5,200 pairs of gloves, and 180 protective eye goggles.
And the individual parents are also sending small packages to the college, not only to their child. So that kind of selflessness and generosity is truly remarkable. This action between China and the U.S. beyond the Vassar, right? It's really demonstrate the importance of a global collaboration. And when we appreciate the actions of Vassar parents, we ourselves also want to continue work toward like collaborating effort to fight this pandemic. And I believe we can end it.
Pepe Qiu is 2021 class advisor and professor of Chinese and Japanese at Vassar College. Vassar and China have longstanding links. The first Chinese Vassar student graduated in 1919. And in the summer of 2019, Vassar launched a summer program for gifted high school students in Beijing. And now, a New York City pediatric nurse reflects on her role in the COVID-19 pandemic.
Most of the time, the nurses are the only people that are going in the rooms. The doctors don't even go in the rooms. So we're stuck in those rooms for like hours at a time.
Caitlin Roberts, former pediatric nurse, currently taking care of adult COVID patients, Weill Cornell, New York Presbyterian Hospital.
Never taking care of an intubated patient until this week. I put a surgical cap on my head, I put my goggles on, I have a surgical mask, and then when I'm going into the rooms, I'm putting a protective gown on, and I'm putting my N95 mask on with a surgical mask over it. And then after I put all of it on, then I put a second surgical cap on, and then two pairs of gloves. February, I had like two trips. I went on plane four times, and now I wouldn't even think of doing that. I became a nurse because I wanted to help people, and people need my help right now. But I can't wait until we can go back to our normal unit and working with kids.
Anya Schultz produced this interview with pediatric nurse Caitlin Roberts. Every year, the Carey Institute for Global Good in rural Albany County, New York, serves as a refuge for journalists and documentarians from around the globe through its Logan nonfiction program. Its latest residencies wrapped in March, just before the pandemic took hold. Fellows have been tackling subjects ranging from climate change to the U.S. prison system. 51%'s Jesse King stopped by the campus in Rensselaerville and has this report.
Filmmakers Zara Katz and investigative reporter Lisa Reardon-Seville are working on the in-progress documentary Women on the Outside. They've been observing the U.S. prison system for a long time. Starting with the collaborative Instagram feed Everyday Incarceration in 2014, the pair amassed a nearly 40-year archive of photography centered on inmates in prisons throughout the country. Reardon-Seville says that's how their newest project was born.
One piece of the puzzle that was really missing was the way in which women support loved ones inside and the rippling effect of incarceration. And so we spoke to women across the country about their experience of supporting a loved one and then ended up connecting with a number of them, including Crystal Bush, who at the time was running a van service called Bridging the Gap. She picked up women around Philadelphia and drove them to visit their loved ones in prison.
Crystal Bush of Philadelphia ended up becoming the main focus of Women on the Outside. When Katz and Reardon-Seville met Bush 4 years ago, she was 27 and had seen nearly all the men in her life locked up, including her father, brother, ex-boyfriend, and several cousins. And Bush's experience wasn't necessarily uncommon in her urban, mostly black neighborhood. In 2015, the New York Times estimated more than 30,000 black men between the ages of 25 and 54 were missing from everyday life in the city, with many behind bars. Driving hours across the state as Bridging the Gap was her way of not only supporting others in her position, but of making ends meet. Reardon-Seville says caring for a loved one in prison is more expensive than you might think.
For many years, phone calls were extremely expensive, so people were paying a lot of money to keep in touch with their loved ones. They put money on their commissary for their loved ones to eat and buy underwear and buy socks and buy deodorant and buy toothpaste, and that could amount to anything between $20 to several hundred dollars a month, depending on how much you had to give and how many people in prison you were supporting. The trips are very long, and they can be hundreds of miles to go visit someone, which means a day off work. And then, you know, people talk about the difficulty of walking out the door and leaving their loved one behind.
Reardon-Seville says Bush's father and brother were both released from prison shortly after they started filming, with almost 40 collective years behind bars. Other documentaries have depicted the obstacles faced by parolees upon reentry. Many struggle to find jobs, make ends meet, and avoid breaking the strict rules of their parole. The subject is also increasingly relevant. New York became the latest state to eliminate cash bail for most nonviolent offenses earlier this year, a move that has since received its fair share of backlash. Pennsylvania hasn't followed suit on the legislative level, but Philadelphia's courts recently agreed to small changes that could result in more people being released pre-trial. Lately, in an effort to decongest prisons during the coronavirus pandemic, the state moved to temporarily release potentially thousands of nonviolent offenders. While this wasn't the specific case in Bush's family, Reardon-Seville and Katz say inmates still rely on the women in their lives once they get out of prison, and the complexities of that experience are typically overlooked.
Crystal, for instance, you know, she grew up in the time that her father was in prison. She was a small child when he went away, and, you know, she's an adult. She owns a home, she has a job, she has a business, and so figuring out how to balance that can be really challenging. And again, stigmatized, because the last thing you want to say is, I'm tired of helping.
Yeah. With our film, you see that Crystal is helping her father pay rent. She finds an apartment for him while he's even still in, but, you know, hopeful with a release date that she's paying rent for an apartment for several months. She actually became the guardian of her brother's son while he was still incarcerated, because there was a potential of the son going into foster care. And then when her brother came home, really hopeful that they would build a relationship, but it just wasn't a reality that his father was going to be able to take him full time. So then actually moving forward for a full adoption, even though she doesn't have any kids of her own, she became a parent because of prison.
Katz says both Bush's father and brother ended up violating their parole and returning to prison. After years of taking weekend trips to Philadelphia to speak with her family and van patrons, Katz and Reardon-Seville are done filming. Their stay at the Cary Institute involved hours in the campus basement, editing rooms, stitching the story together clip by clip. They say much of the film will center on Bush's van rides with Bridge the Gap, featuring conversations with some of her regular riders and depicting the many ways in which women on the outside support one another.
There's a real heavy stigma around being connected to somebody in prison, something that is not talked about. And so in focusing on Crystal and her van service, there was this really incredible element of community where most of her riders were women and families, and occasionally men would ride the van as well, but, you know, majority women, and they'd get on the van and they really started building community in this way where they could talk about some of these things.
I think we want to build a film that allows women who have had this experience and who are in this experience to feel less alone and to talk about it, and that allows people who have never considered this experience to sit with it and understand that this is a story about incarceration, but also about love and friendship.
Women on the Outside does not yet have a release date. The Cary Institute's Logan Nonfiction Program has supported over 150 journalists and documentarians since it began in 2015. I'm Jesse King for 51%.
Before COVID-19 curtailed gatherings, there was a gathering of strange girls who will gather again. A Conspiracy of Strange Girls is a Twin Cities arts collective, open to all women, femme-identifying, non-binary, or genderqueer people, creating art dealing with the unusual, the unfamiliar, or the mysterious.
I fit into the Conspiracy of Strange Girls because I enjoy making art that's a little bit different. Making art based on scary monsters and different creatures from folktales.
I'm strange. I like art that's a little bit dark. I feel like that's kind of how I fit in. We all embrace the dark side of ourselves.
The Conspiracy of Strange Girls is a collective of women and femme-identifying individuals that do art together and put on shows and markets. There's artwork that goes anywhere from textiles to painting to performance. My name is Danielle Pebbles. My specific role is to help coordinate our annual event and small shows, specifically gallery shows. We have a micro show usually like every other month that's for our visual artists. Anyone in our collective can stand up and essentially run a show or do whatever they need to do and know that they're going to have the support of the conspiracy behind them to do everything that they can in every aspect.
Hi, my name is Monica Helland, and I make soft sculptures. I screen print textiles and basically sew them together and turn them into various art pieces. This piece is called Ode to Alice, and it's basically my representation of what Alice in Wonderland is. So the pieces are for your shelf. They're about a foot and a half tall, and they have like fur around the outside, kind of like a old circus punk from the circus punk games. The front of them is screen printed with the character, and then I hand painted some of the colors onto it as well. And then scattered around the bottom of the sculpture are little screen printed hearts that I stuffed and sewed together.
Conspiracy of Strange Girls, the word conspiracy is one that we're kind of creating our own vocabulary for. So it's like a gaggle of geese or a laughter of unicorns. Conspiracy is like a murder of crows. It's our way that we're trying to say what our group is. I think everyone probably has their own tale. When you make something that's atypical or like you're still trying to discover what the weirdness is that your thoughts are, oddities, or maybe a little bit going towards a darker storytelling, curious and just strange things.
Marty McConnell, and I do assemblage and collage art. This one is actually about 90% found objects. The base is a picture frame. There's a candlestick on it. And attached to the candlestick with clay is a ukulele with all the strings off and a piece cut out of the middle. And in that middle part is a tombstone and kind of a spider web piece. And then the ukulele has some wings on it about the middle of the fretboard that were part of a broken wind chime. The very top on the head of the ukulele is a coffin, and it's all been painted and distressed in many different layers of paint. It's glue, it's screws, stuff that I had to drill into and attach. Whatever works.
I have a long history of not getting in to certain shows and events. And a few years back, I became unemployed. it was really hard for me, and I was having a hard time trying to find an art job out there. I just wanted to go somewhere where I could work on my own artwork, feel very respected, and work with any type of curiosity that I had. With the Strange Girls, I've been moving into more of a three-dimensional space that is new for me. So I started making 3-foot dollhouses that you can open up, and they're interactive, where people can leave me messages or take a message of whatever they need. With my paintings, they really fall into the line of a lot of dark fairy tales. Not exactly illustrations, but more of like a description of an anxiety of time. When is this place? What is happening? Why is it timeless? And why is it once upon a time?
My name is Sarah Holm, and my piece is called Tentacles. It is all made out of recycled materials. My piece is about 10 feet tall and a cylinder of hanging tentacle-like bike tubes cut into strips. And then the inside has a bunch of fabric that I tore apart discarded clothing that I got in dumpsters or scraps, sewed it back together to make the tendrils that you see on the inside of the sculpture. I make pieces that kind of speak to things that are in nature. So this piece was inspired by a jellyfish.
And I also really enjoy circus art, so I wanted to do pieces that kind of look like circus punks.
There's a few pieces that are literally things I saw laying on the sidewalk, picked up and cleaned up.
I think that if you have this curiosity of the strange, you want to go and find other people that have the curiosity of the strange.
This piece was produced by KFAI's Dixie Trichel. Gilles Malkin brings us a profile from his Women in History series, focusing on a doctor who refused to bow to corporate pressure and release a drug without adequate testing.
If there is one modern-day windmill against which it seems futile to tilt, the dominance of big pharmaceutical companies surely looms as a prime candidate. But tilt we must. And millions of us owe a great debt for our health and well-being to a seldom-heard-of woman who took up a particular fight against them with signal success. This was the Canadian Dr. Frances Oldham Kelsey, born in Cobble Hill, British Columbia, on July 24, 1914. After high school, Kelsey enrolled at McGill University, where she earned first a Bachelor of Science degree in 1934, then a Master of Science in 1935. It was suggested to her that she then address an application to the University of Chicago for a job in their new pharmacology department, which was returned with approval to Mr. Oldham. Unaware he had hired a woman, Professor Eugene Gelling nonetheless welcomed her into the group in 1936. She was to earn a Ph.D. there and would later become part of its faculty. In 1937, she took part in a project whose results indicated that deaths were occurring from the use of diethylene glycol, a solvent that had been added to an S.E. Massengill Company sulfa drug and topped off with raspberry syrup in the happy form of an elixir. It wasn't until 100 people died from it that it was noticed there might be a problem. The company denied any blame whatsoever and awaited a court verdict even as their concoction's originator committed suicide. The company was fined, but only for using the word elixir for a product that contained no alcohol. But the public reaction to this case spawned the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, passed in 1938 to protect us from new, untested medications. It was through this research that Dr. Kelsey's interest became focused on drugs called teratogens, whose toxic effects could attack the embryo or fetus, enabled by their ability to penetrate the placenta. Her dedication to this field was no doubt sustained by the milestone drug regulation to which her work had contributed. 22 years later, she was working for the Food and Drug Administration in Washington as a medical officer in charge of reviewing applications for new drug approvals. One of these was for a sedative and painkiller for expectant mothers called Cavedon, now better known as thalidomide, the idea of which was welcomed with great relief, as its intent was to combat morning sickness. It had been synthesized in West Germany in 1957 and was being sold in many countries under different brand names. But something bothered Kelsey about it, a European study had discovered neurological side effects and suggested the drug might be a possible cause of an often fatal condition called peripheral neuritis, which brought on severe nerve damage. Although it had been approved and was being used in Europe and Canada, Dr. Kelsey refused to grant U.S. approval until she could be sure it was as harmless as was being claimed. She dug in her heels and began a long and hard fight for additional data on the drug, causing its manufacturer, the Merrill Company, to complain bitterly to her higher-ups that she was being unfairly demanding and needlessly nosy. Thankfully, her bosses defended her insistence for more information because, as case after case soon showed, besides possibly affecting the mothers, it was causing congenital malformation to newborns, resulting in conditions such as cleft palate, disfigurement, blindness, deafness, and severe internal problems. It also resulted in what was considered its most egregious consequence, a condition called focomelia, or shortened limbs, where no arms or legs are present but hands and feet grow directly out from the torso. Even though the drug was not yet approved, U.S. doctors received samples during the application approval wait, which found their way to approximately 20,000 U.S. patients between 1958 and 1961. And no one can be sure of the number of people or births it affected. Considering the drug company's eagerness and willingness and ability to let the world benefit from its product, it was solely thanks to Dr. Kelsey's vigilance that thousands more cases in the U.S. and in the drug markets all across the globe were averted. Dr. Francis Oldham Kelsey received the President's Award for Distinguished Federal Civilian Service in 1962 from President John F. Kennedy, becoming only the second woman upon which that honor had been bestowed. She was inducted into the Women's Hall of Fame in the year 2000, and it will come as no surprise that she did not retire until the age of 90. She died in London, Ontario, August 7, 2015, at the age of 101, the day after she was named to the Order of Canada, an award only for those who have demonstrated the highest degree of merit to Canada and to humanity. Thanks for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Gilles Malkin is a writer, musician, actor, composer, and advocate for people with disabilities. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1606.